the burden of another's pain. Some spend forever for a moment's gain. Everybody's got to find their own way through. But if you love,
everybody's got to find their own way through. Well, hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, seven revolutions later, balancing into yet another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler, and that, of course, was Bruce Cockburn with Love Loves You Too from his 1994 Dart to the Heart release. Bruce plays the Wheeler Opera House tomorrow night at 7:30, and just 15 minutes ago, there were only 62 seats remaining for that show. So it looks like you need to get right on it if you want to remind yourself in person how good Bruce Cockburn really is. Picture how your life might be if you knew the day you would die. How would that affect the way you live that day? Or, for that matter, your entire life leading up to that day? Would you ignore it? Would you practice a casual shuck and jive? Would you indulge in a heedless hedonism? Would you embrace the love in your life, or would you shiver in cold fear and loathing? Chloe Benjamin's new novel, The Immortalists, deals with these and other questions. Chloe definitely avoided the sophomore slump with this, her second work of fiction, a New York Times bestseller. I spoke with Chloe earlier this week about The Immortalists. Chloe Benjamin, welcome to Express Yourself.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for writing a book that kept me turning the pages all weekend long. It was not a waste of time, so thank you.
Oh, good. I hope not to write waste of time books.
Well, I haven't read your first one, which was The Anatomy of Dreams, but after reading The Immortalists, I have to read that, I think. But are you happy with the way Immortalists has turned out?
I am. I mean, it's been a really amazing experience, and that's a question. I like your question because that's not one that I usually get asked. It's certainly been a whirlwind, and I'm prone to anxiety, so not without its stressors, but my publishing house has just been so, so phenomenal and worked so hard to bring this book to readers, and it's been amazing to see readers enjoying it, too.
How long did it take you to write this book, Chloe Benjamin?
Well, it took about 2.5 years for a first draft. And then from there, I would say it was another 2 or so years working with my publisher, doing edits and revisions for them, starting to plan ahead for publicity and marketing. So, 4.5, 5 years from conception until now.
Wow. So you've lived with this thing for 4 or 5 years. How about that?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I think it was in part the research that took a particularly long time for this book. It covers about 50 years and 4 different people's lives. And so I really wanted to make sure that I was doing all of that work as authentically and with as much integrity as I could. So, yeah, if it were just the writing, it would have probably been shorter, but there was a lot of other work involved, too.
The research is obvious, and actually that was one of my later questions. But let's start with the premise of the book, which is, how would you react if you knew the date of your death? And you frame that question in the lives of 4 characters, all part of a family. What happened to those 4 children in 1969?
Well, they hear of the arrival of a mysterious woman who is rumored to be able to tell anyone the date that they will die. And the siblings are, they're in this curious historical moment. Like you said, it's 1969. There's so much happening in the world, but they're kids. And so there's not a whole lot happening to them. And so they decide that they're going to do this adventurous errand, and it winds up impacting the rest of their lives.
In ways that one can barely imagine, you know. But it's a fascinating question. Let's talk about some of the characters. Very rich, very sympathetic characters. Let's start with the youngest, Simon. Describe Simon for our listeners.
Well, it's not giving too much away since this all comes out in the first 30 pages or so, but Simon knows that he's gay. He's growing up in a conservative Jewish family, and he knows that they would not approve. And he uses the prophecy as motivation to start living the life that he wants. And so he leaves home at 16, and he runs away to San Francisco.
And he ends up there late 70s, right, and living into the early 80s.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, I think if you know the timeline, that, you know, it's clear that San Francisco is moving into the AIDS crisis. But for me, his section of the book is less about a kind of suspense or thriller-esque question about, you know, what he eventually finds himself in the middle of, as it is an exploration of this moment in time and this community who has finally found a safe place in which to express themselves and then is hit by unimaginable tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you bring that tragedy to life so well in the guise of the lover that Simon finds. Robert, describe Robert's and Simon's relationship, if you would.
Yeah, well, Robert is also a gay man, but he, in addition, is an African-American man. And one of the things that was interesting to me in researching for Simon's section was finding out how white the Castro was. Castro was the famous, you know, gay neighborhood in San Francisco. And even though, you know, the gay men who lived there were maligned and victims of oppression themselves, in some ways that culture kind of reinforced traditional power structures. Like I said, it was a really white world, and people of color faced an enormous risk to their safety in San Francisco at the time. So Robert is, I didn't want him to simply be a symbol of that. He is his own person, but he's also able to reflect back to Simon a different perspective.
And, you know, Simon went to San Francisco with his sister, Clara, and Clara called Robert classy in the book. And and I would say that Simon comes to two or three very transcendent moments, one of them being the first time that he tells Robert, "I love you," which is on stage, no less. And the other, I mean, you know, what a glorious way to say "I love you" to the person you love when he's holding you aloft as if you are flying. On stage.
yeah. So what you're referring to is that they are dancers. So Simon, he becomes a dancer when he moves to San Francisco, and he struggles to be honest with his feelings, even as he, you know, has a really robust sense of his sexuality. And so that's the moment where he's able to be vulnerable, but in a kind of unexpected stage.
Yes, and the other transcendent moment in the Simon section was his deathbed scene. Oh my God! I wonder if you'd be kind enough to read part of that for us.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, sigh! There is a strangled cry, like something that would come from a chained dog. Clara puts a palm over her mouth when she realizes it's hers. I wish, don't wish it. Look what she gave me. This, says Clara, looking at the lesions on his arms, his sharp ribs, even his blonde mane has thinned. After an aide helps him bathe, the drain is matted with curls. No, says Simon, this. And he points at the window. I would never have come to San Francisco if it weren't for her. I wouldn't have met Robert. I'd never have learned how to dance. I'd probably still be home waiting for my life to begin. He's angry with the disease. He rages at the disease. For so long, he hated the woman, too. How, he wondered, could she give such a terrible fortune to a child? But now he thinks of her differently, like a second mother or a god, she who showed him the door and said, go. Clara looks paralyzed. Simon remembers the expression he saw on her face after they moved to San Francisco, that eerie combination of irritation and indulgence, and he realizes why it disturbed him. She reminded him of the woman, counting down, watching him. Inside him, a bud of love for his sister breaks open. He thinks of her on the rooftop, how she stood at the edge and spoke without looking at him. Give me one good reason why you shouldn't start your life. You aren't surprised that it's Sunday, Simon says. You knew all along. Your date, Clara whispers. You said it was young. I wanted you to have everything you've ever wanted. Simon squeezes Clara's hand. Her palm is fleshy, a healthy pink. But I do, he says.
That is just gorgeous. Thank you for writing that.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I can't say that Simon's siblings came to the same kind of transcendent understanding of the kind of gift and curse that the gypsy woman gave them. And you know, Simon was the first to die. He was the youngest. He was only 20 when he died. Mm-hmm. And yet he came to the understanding that you just read. And that's really remarkable. And as I said, his siblings, a couple of them, weren't as lucky. We don't really have to get into Clara and Daniel, although both of them are equally compelling characters, and each in their way comes to a partial understanding, I would say, of what it was that the gypsy woman fortune teller did for them. But I want to focus a little bit on Varya, because I would say that Varya, who's the eldest of the four, in her own way came to an equally deep understanding. She is a longevity researcher, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And tell me...
You're right. So she is... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So she is researching how to extend the human lifespan. And what she wants to do is not just to extend lifespan, but to extend health span, the healthy years of one's life. Because, after all, it might not be so much good to live a long time if you're not in very good shape. So that's what she's working on.
Uh-huh. And she also suffers from obsessive compulsive disorder, doesn't she?
She does. Yeah. I think she, you know, she's racked by a sense of guilt and responsibility after what happened to her family. And OCD for her is a way to organize and control her life.
Yeah. By the time that Varya comes to an understanding of what she's dealing with here, all three of her siblings have died. A couple of them none of them really in a very savory manner, but Varya's understanding of the whole dynamic comes to her through a journalist who comes to interview her mm-hmm. and her research, and this journalist is not exactly what he appears to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. So the mystery of the final section is this cat and mouse between somebody who is coming to the lab where Varya works and is carrying out her study and interviewing her, and he begins to challenge her about her life and her expectations. And I won't give away the twist, but I think that she experiences a transformation because of him.
She does. She does indeed. In fact, she does a complete 180, doesn't she? Pretty much. I mean,
yeah, I think...
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I think that in comparison to all of her siblings, Varya probably undergoes the most change, which is interesting because you don't necessarily expect that that's going to be the case. But she starts out living with a lot of rigidity, and her attempts at control have made her live a pretty narrow life in some ways. And by the end of the section, she's able to see something different.
Chloe, do you read the comics?
I haven't in some time. I used to. Why do you ask?
A couple of months ago, Mother Goose and Grimm. Are you familiar with that one? There's two dogs in that family.
I'm not.
One named Grimmy and one named Ralph, and they're hanging out on their mother's on their mother's sofa. You know, just hanging on the arms of the sofa, and Grimmy turns to Ralph and goes, "Ralph, what would you do tomorrow if you knew you were gonna die?" And do you know what Ralph says?
Nothing.
Ralph says, "I'd wake up early."
That's good. I like that one.
I thought of that.
Very cute.
I thought of that as I read your book, because you're dealing with the eternal verities here, and in a way that, isn't a treatise. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I didn't want to write a book that, you know, was telling anyone how to feel about these big questions, but rather I hope it's one that will prompt conversation and allow people to think through some of these questions for themselves.
You bring in so many threads in this family story, and this gets back at the research that you is so obviously prodigious. You obviously did your research about 1980 San Francisco, about magic because Clara was a magician, about the Romani or the gypsy people because, of course, it was a gypsy lady that, that gave this prophecy to the kids. Longevity research, all of it, mental illness is in there. There's a lot going on. It's a pretty remarkable summation of where we've been in the last 40 or 50 years.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. I certainly feel like you can't write about 50 years without writing about the country in which those years take place. And it was fascinating to see how resonant many of these issues still are. You know, just as the characters of the early 20th century are dealing with immigration and discrimination, so too we find ourselves dealing with that in our culture today. That's just one example of many, you know. I mean, gay rights, feminism, there's so much that we continue to return to as Americans, and I hope we continue to see progress.
Did you have a pretty clear idea of the characters and the plot before you did your research, or did a lot of those details of character and plot evolve as you did the research?
I think it was a little bit of both. I tend to have an idea of where I want something to end up. So I did know, you know, the first three sections, I wanted them to end a certain way. I had an idea of the ending for the book, but some of those did change. And that's kind of the fun part. So even though I'm somebody who struggles with change and uncertainty, I think that my fiction is one of the rare places where I embrace it. And I think the kind of playfulness and the delight of a first draft is the part that I enjoy the most.
Oh, interesting. Well, before I let you go, Chloe, I have to ask you, if you knew the date of your death, would you want to know that?
I don't think I would, because if it were bad news, it would just be too hard not to ruminate and feel sorry for myself. I wish I could say I'd be somebody who grabbed life by the horns, but I think more likely I'd be crying over in a corner asking why me. So I would say no. What about you?
You know, I think I don't think it matters, to tell you the truth, because you're going to live, I don't know, if you're living a pretty realized life. I mean, nobody's perfect, but if you're aware that that's sort of the reason why we're all here is to spiritually evolve, then, you know, there's a due date. I don't know. I guess we're all going to die, and I guess I don't know. I guess it's the choice between knowledge and mystery is what we're talking about here, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting perspective. I love talking with people about this stuff because I certainly don't have all the answers just because I wrote the book. I'm learning too.
Huh. Well, Chloe Benjamin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's a splendid read, and I guess you can get it just about anywhere. Is that right, the book?
Yeah, I would say so. I always say support your local indies, indie bookstores. They've been so wonderful to this book. You should be able to get it wherever books are sold, as they say.
Well, good luck with your next one. I wait with bated breath. I'm going to have to read The Anatomy of Dreams. And do you have a good idea for your next one already, or is that still forming?
I do. And in fact, I'm so excited about the idea that I don't say anything about it because I'm afraid somebody will take it if I do. I think there's my superstition coming in, but I am at work on it.
Okay. Chloe, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. This was such a pleasure.
Likewise. Take care now. Chloe Benjamin, author of The Immortalists. And last week, she stood at number 13 on the New York Times bestseller list. Okay, if you're just tuned in, this is the Express Yourself show on KDNK. Stay with me. More to come on Express Yourself. Front Range Bluegrass Band Chain Station with a nice instrumental called No Contest. Chain Station returns to Steve's Guitars tomorrow night at 8:30. And congratulations to Amy Levinson for snagging those free tickets to see Walt Whitman or Kim Nuzzo as Walt Whitman tomorrow night. I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. So begins this nation's first great poem, Song of Myself, written by Walt Whitman and first published in 1855. Ever since then, the father of free verse has lived in the American imagination as the embodiment of a free man, unfettered, unbound by any dogma or dictum. Kim and Valerie Nuzzo have created a one-man stage show, which comes to the Temporary tomorrow night, and I had the chance to speak with Kim Nuzzo yesterday. Kim Nuzzo, welcome to Express Yourself. Well, we're talking because you are embodying a pretty amazing character named Walt Whitman. You know, it's been 199 years since Walt's birth and 164 years since Leaves of Grass, his seminal work, was first published. Why is he still a compelling character in the 21st century?
Well, I think, you know, in my view, it's because he really is you know, I think he is the closest thing America has to what I would call a saint. and so his, you know, his economic presence just it lives on. And as a lover of democracy and the democratic ideals, which I think, you know, we go through these phases in our country where they sometimes appear to be diminishing, but they come back. And I think one of the reasons that they come back is because there are ideals that our poets and artists and, you know, some of our famous, I would use the word, agitators and freedom fighters, keep them alive. And that's the reason I think Whitman is still such a presence for us today, is it because he, you know, transcended this kind of messy democracy that we live in and held on to what are the beautiful ideals about it.
Huh. You know, it occurs to me that, you know, his book was first published in the run-up to the Civil War, and I'm sure that that was a pretty important event in his life, as well as the lives of all his colleagues and the people that he lived. Was he a man of his times?
He was definitely a man of his times, and I'm glad you mentioned the Civil War, because our play, one of the things that it focuses on, because our play is a form of it's a type of historical fiction. It uses mostly Walt's words, some from his poetry, some important pieces from Leaves of Grass, but a lot from his journals, and specifically the book Specimen Days. But in our play, one of the ideas that we deal with is that Walt, because Walt saw between 80,000 and 100,000 sick and wounded soldiers in Washington, D.C., in the hospitals during the Civil War, as a volunteer nurse, unpaid, and every day would go to the hospitals and visit young men, mostly whom were in the process of dying. You know, by the end of the war, 18,000 had died in the hospitals of D.C. But Whitman, we believe, experienced what today we call PTSD from the trauma of how many young men he was close to and nursed who were suffering with really no hope of recovery.
Wow.
And, you know, that is a very important part of the play. And the other thing is that Whitman really believed that his poetry could stop the war.
Huh.
In his journals, he wrote, his exact words are, the war and my book are one. I thought if people would just read the poems, they would realize there is no difference between us. We have more in common than separates us.
How about that?
Yeah.
Not a popular view at the time.
No, it sure wasn't.
Although
sure wasn't.
He had several bones to pick with abolitionists. I mean, you know, abolitionists were definitely, he was among them, but I mean, he didn't march in lockstep with them, did he?
No, that's right, Luke. He, you know, he had, and I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, we try to show that in our play too, the real Whitman. You know, he evolved like a lot of human beings do in his thinking about things. In the beginning, he more identified with the free soil movement, which was the idea that slavery would be banned in any of the new states coming into the Union. But, you know, over time, he began to identify more and more with abolitionists. And his mother was a follower of an itinerant Quaker preacher named Elias Hicks, who was an abolitionist. So, you know, on the one hand, he had his father's, you know, his father's rather rigid views, and his mother's kind of warm acceptance of everyone. And he battled with those, but he eventually, you know, he evolved to more completely identify that, you know, slavery was abhorrent and needed to be gone forever.
Huh. Wow, how about that? Well, you know,
yeah.
So he had some Quaker antecedents. His parents were Quakers.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, and you know, his there were other things in his upbringing too that were significant. You know, it was a large family. He was the second child of eight. His father was kind of an unsuccessful builder who tried different things. He was probably alcoholic. He never read a word of Whitman's poetry. You know, he died when Whitman was 36, and you know, he took Walt out of school. You know, Walt, that's another thing I think is an interesting piece, how many iconic heroes we have that are self-made, self-taught, self-educated men, which Whitman was. He only had a sixth grade education.
Really?
Formal education. Even though he was, you know, he nurtured an envy for people with a classical education, so he went about educating himself by being a voracious reader.
Do you think that accounted for his populist tendencies, his championing of the common man?
Absolutely, I do. You know, he built houses with his father. He worked hard as a carpenter in different periods of his young life, and I definitely think that that was part of his identification with the common man.
Huh. So as a young man, he kind of frittered around the edges of newspapers. He was a little bit of a journalist, wasn't he?
That's right. And that, you know, that formed one of the ways that we looked at his life and found a way to write a play that has enough, you know, conflict in it was by wondering about how this man, who was really, you know, a pretty mediocre, undistinguished journalist, all of a sudden in 1855 began to write, which many consider, you know, in that century, the most brilliant, unique, radical piece of literature written in that time. Well, how did that happen? It was almost, because it did almost happen overnight.
Did he sell his soul to the devil? How did that happen?
Well, our theory is that it grew out of the pain of having to deal with his own sexuality in a time when the word homosexual did not even exist. There was no such word. Mm-hmm. Dealing with that, and also the pain and PTSD of the suffering that he saw and experienced firsthand during the Civil War. Hmm. Both of those things. From that came some kind of, you know, I guess I would call it some kind of spiritual awakening.
Feeling ostracized and
yes.
And in pain, spiritual pain.
That's right, exactly.
How do you embody that on the stage, Kim?
Well, it was you know, first of all, I give a lot of credit to the woman, my wife, who directed the play. And that's Valerie Haugen-Nuzzo.
Uh-huh.
Because from the very start, one of her goals and focuses was, how do we bring, you know, physicality to a, you know, a little over an hour length play where there's just one person on the stage. And so, you know, that requires, one, bringing a lot of emotion. And a lot of that emotion came from this actual PTS experience that Walt goes through in looking back and thinking about the Civil War and thinking about what he saw in these hospitals. So there are some very dark parts of the play where Walt is really reliving these painful experiences that he went through. And he also, from the very beginning of the play, is open about his sexuality, which I think is very disarming to audiences, because he actually talks about, you know, his one true male lover, Peter Doyle, and what it felt like when that relationship ended, and Walt basically, you know, for some period of time, just lived a lonely existence, and you know, and he's open about his list of one night stands, and this is a part that, you know, we wondered about how audiences were going to react. I remember the first time this a man in the audience who was from the Twin Cities came up to me after the play, and he said, you know, when Walt talks about these one-night stands he has, it made me very, very uncomfortable. But I'm glad when something makes me very, very uncomfortable. It makes me take a look at something.
So he fulfilled your objective, I'm imagining.
He did, really, absolutely. Huh. And I think that is a good question. Like, how does an actor, how does a work of art, you know, embody that emotional piece? I mean, that's really the artist's job, I believe, is to somehow find that place in himself so that others can see it demonstrated in front of them, and that allows them to feel it in themselves.
You mentioned earlier the idea of having to carry the entire show just on your shoulders. An hour alone on stage is a challenge enough, but I'm thinking that in this case, an equal challenge, if maybe not a surpassing challenge, is how do you embody a man who's larger than life? How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any magic to it. It's it's been something that we've been studying for a few years now. It didn't happen overnight. And I too, probably like you, I'm not sure, but I, as a teenage boy in the early 60s, you know, carried around a copy of Leaves of Grass with me. So, you know, Walt Whitman is a person that I have been able to identify with myself for a very long time. I'm not sure I could even describe exactly what it was. It may be that thing that you mentioned before. It's maybe that as an adolescent, when you go through the angst of feeling like an outsider, that when you read someone else that embodies that feeling of being different, of being outside of the mainstream, you know, something happens. You know, Walt has never disappeared from me. And this play, when I talked to Valerie about it, it's not a play that I planned on doing once and then stop doing. I'm 72 years old. I plan on doing Walt Whitman for the rest of my life. You know, I'm hoping to do it. I'm going to be doing it down here at the college for their English department. We've done it in Scotland at the Fringe Festival. I think it's a message that's universal that needs to be kept alive. So I think of it more as almost a personal mission to continue to bring, you know, Walt's message to the public. You know, a lot of high school kids I've talked to that have been at the play have told me they did not know who Walt Whitman was.
Huh. Wow. So it's sort of like Hal Holbrook performing Mark Twain.
I wouldn't put myself in that category.
No,
it is what I would like to do is to continue to perform Walt wherever there may be an audience for him.
So, how long have you been performing this?
This is the first performance took place at our little theater, Zephyr Stage, here in Fruita. Uh-huh. Last July, at the end of July, we performed. We did it 5 times here.
Okay.
And then from there, we took it to Scotland to the Fringe Festival, where we performed it for a week.
Ooh,
every day.
That sounds fun.
That was great fun to do it in Scotland to an international audience. Huh. It was great. Huh. And then we brought it back here and have done it. We had a full house at Thunder River Theater when we did it. And we've done it in Grand Junction. We've done it in Salida at the Steam Plant Theater there. Uh-huh. We're lined up to do it at Western States College, too, at the end of this summer. So it's been about.
It must be fun.
It is fun.
You know, standing there and as I said earlier, you know, embodying somebody larger than life. But what an amazing life and what an amazing outlook. I mean, I celebrate myself and sing myself and what I assume you shall assume. Isn't that how it goes?
And that's exactly how it goes. There are so many great lines from Walt, like, I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, he's speaking to us. Look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless and filter and fiber your blood.
He was channeling something, wasn't he, Kim?
He was. That's right. He was. You know, he was speaking to generations to come. You know, he really was. He's really saying to us. You know, there's another line of his that he says, "I myself write but one or two indicative words for the future. I myself advance but a moment, only to wheel and hurry back into the darkness. I am a man who, sauntering along, takes a casual glance at you, then averts his face, leaving it to you." That means us, leaving it to you to prove and define it, expecting the main things from you. It's an invitation to us that this song of myself is really a song of ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's a river. It's a river of optimism that must be carried on. You carry it on. I carry it on. If you have some belief or hope in the human experiment, you're with Walt.
I guess the reason, Kim, that he still resonates these days is because he was the first to have that all-embodying inclusivity, and he was the first to inject that into the public sphere.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Huh.
You know, he said each person has their place here in this procession, that life and the universe itself is a procession, and everyone has their place.
He was...
So I don't know, at a time when we have these issues, we're dealing with, you know, issues about immigration, issues about inclusivity versus exclusivity, all of those things, Walt's message is very, very timely in terms of asking people to think about what is a democratic ideal.
Wow. Huh. Yeah. And, you know, in his time, it must have been absolutely shocking, the messages that
it was. It was. You know, Leaves of Grass was eventually banned.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when Walt went to Washington, D.C., which he was invited to do on a steamboat filled with wounded soldiers, you know, where there weren't enough people to take care of him, he was invited to come to Washington. The way he supported himself were with little insignificant government jobs that he had, that he could only keep from time to time, because he was fired once by the Secretary of Treasury because he was judged to be a decidedly disreputable person, is what the Solomon Chase, the Secretary of State, called him. Secretary of Treasury called him. And, you know, another bureaucrat in Washington thought his work was obscene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so his book in his time was definitely not looked upon with, you know, great honor. There were some near the end of his life that were starting to recognize the brilliance of his poetry and how unique it was, you know, which is another thing. Walt is the more or less the inventor of free verse, which distinguished American poetry at that time. And now 90% of poetry written in the world is free verse.
Yeah.
That comes from Walt Whitman.
Yeah. 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 And yet he was capable of writing a very tender elegy upon Abraham Lincoln's assassination.
Yes. Yes.
Several of them.
Several of them.
Yeah.
When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Oh, Captain, my Captain. When I was in grade school, high school, those were poems that you were asked to memorize. But I don't think they do that anymore. I don't know.
I think you're right. Yeah, maybe they make them remember hip-hop lyrics or something.
That's right. That's okay, too.
But, yeah. You know, isn't it interesting that 150, 60 years later, we have another group of people that was marginalized, and they are finding their empowerment in words just the way Walt Whitman did.
Absolutely. Yes.
So that's a universal thing, I guess.
Yeah, it is. The power. The power as well as the mystery of words and what they can do.
Yeah. Wow. Well, what a great subject. It sounds like it'll be a very interesting show over at the Temporary. And do you have plans to bring it back to the Valley again after that?
You know, I don't want to overdo it at this point.
Yeah.
No plans to bring it back. But, you know, I'm always looking for, you know, some of the audiences that you don't hit with a performance in a theater, like adolescents or in high schools or colleges, those kinds of things. So hopefully it will come back to the Valley at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Kim Nuzzo, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for embodying an American icon.
Thanks so much, Luke.
That's Kim Nuzzo. Kim takes the stage at 8 o'clock tomorrow night at the Temporary as Walt Whitman. Thank you for tuning in to today's Express Yourself. Let's go out with a taste of the Deer, who return to Steve's Guitars a week from tonight. Here is Young Sun from Tempest and Rapture. Stay tuned for the news coming right up. And please remember to go out there and express yourself.